कफस उदास है यारो सबास कुछ तो कहो।
Welcome to the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast, also known as the SAS Pod. I am Lalita Duperron, Associate Director in the Center for South Asia. All our podcasts and information about the center are available at southasia.stanford.edu. Today, I am joined by Ambika Vishwanath, who is a co-founder of the Kuber 9 Initiative, which is a think tank in India. Kuber 9 is a Greek word related to governance, and the nerd in me that loves etymology got very excited about that realization. Ambika, welcome to the SAS Pod.
Thank you, Lalita. Lovely to be here.
So Ambika is in the Bay Area and in the United States to explore collaborations. And to that end, she visited Stanford last week, and we will discuss this in the podcast. But before we do that, tell us about the Kuber 9 Initiative.
So the Kuber 9 Initiative was co-founded by Priyanka Bhire and myself in about 2018. She and I were both in between jobs, as one would say, trying to understand what we wanted to do next. I had worked for, at that time, close to 15 years on various things, including looking at water conflict and cooperation, which has been my core area of work. Priyanka is a strategy specialist and has worked in various spaces, both in India and outside of India. And we'd met before, we'd worked before, and we had a very good working friendship, as one would say, and trying to figure out what to do next. We both knew we wanted to stay in India. We'd lived outside of India for years before that, and and sort of understand how we could contribute better to India's future. We were kind of tired of working for other people. We were also largely tired of working for people that had, you know, a lack of vision. And in all of that, we said, you know, why don't we do something on our own? There are hardly any women-founded think tanks that are in the security space and the foreign policy space. And so we said, let's change that conversation a little bit, and let's work on things that we felt that need more attention. You know, how does water or climate affect a more traditional security, if you look at it from a military defense perspective? Where does gender play a role in all of this? Can we talk about urbanization policies in India from a much more holistic lens? You know, so these were the spaces that we said, let's get into. And we started Kuber 9. And now Kuber 9 is turned five earlier this year in February. And here we are.
Before you founded Kuber 9, what were you doing? What was the journey leading to that realization, both in terms of the positive, like you knew what you wanted to do, but also I'm curious about being tired of people without vision, working with people without vision. The push and pull factors, if you will. Tell me about those.
Yeah, so we, you know, I had I studied political science and conflict resolution. I also trained to be a treaty negotiator. And I a little bit stumbled upon water in that I didn't formally study. I'm not a water scientist or an engineer. So, and I had a liberal arts education, which, you know, 25 years ago for an Indian was not so common.
Right.
And I realized the value of learning how water and climate can be a driver for cooperation, can be a driver for peace. I'd seen it in many places. I'd also seen the opposite of that happening. And in my time, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, the idea of the Third World War being on water was a very big conversation. And so I was very curious to see what that actually could look like. And so that's the career path that I took. I worked for an NGO in India, then I worked for a think tank in India. I worked for governments outside of India. I was on projects with the Swiss government, with the Turkish government. And I also spent a couple of years traveling around India through 2016 and 17, where I was working as an independent consultant to understand what change India was going through. And 16, 17 was, I think, a time of a lot of like churn, as they would say. And so in that, I worked for many organizations. I had male bosses and female bosses. I would say there were pros and cons to both, not so much their gender, but because of the person I was working for.
Right.
But in the larger think tank space, at least then, I didn't see the kind of work that I was excited and passionate about, as to how, you know, if we were to talk about climate, can we bring that into the defense sector, for example? Now you see it much more, and I think India's change, also COVID brought a lot of different kinds of thinking into the energy, into that space. So my journey was not a straight one. It was meandering and sort of led me here. I would never have thought I would be an entrepreneur. If you had asked me earlier in my 20s, would you lead your own organization? I would have been like, no way. But here I am. And on most days I love it. On some days I'm like, why am I doing this again?
I think we all understand that. But it's good. I mean, so you're also a role model in some ways, and we can get to that. Let's talk a little bit more about water and water in terms of security, because water seems to be like there's either not enough of it, there's too much of it. And then water is also a part of like the borders, the nation state. How so? What part of water do you look at, or all of it?
So I look at a little bit all of it, I would say, in that how can we place water at the heart of the conversations they need to be a part of, okay? And I would tell many people, you know, I bat for the resource, not the country, not a person, not a situation, but for the resource. Because at the end of the day, that resource is what we need to last, because it's so much a part of everything that we do. If we are talking, I mean, today's day and age, when you say climate, it really just means energy, right? Renewable energy. But water is a part of that conversation. We talk about contentious borders. In many cases, water is a part of that conversation. Conflict, water gets embroiled in conflict. It might not be a direct cause, but it definitely becomes a weapon and a tool. So how do we ensure then that water is safeguarded for the present, for the future? If we are talking about too much water, how can we ensure a much more equitable access to it? In many cases, too little is not because there is no water, it's because we don't have proper access. There is no equitable access. So how can we bring that, elevate that aspect? Water, I have realized in the 2 decades that I've been working on it, it's been a separate conversation. There are water people, and they will only talk about water, and you will have that water bubble. That we need to break that. You need the water people to be everywhere, just as you need the security people to be everywhere, right? And so that's the kind of work that I try to do.
Who are your clients? Who do you work for? What is it that you do on a kind of a day-to-day basis?
So on a day-to-day basis, I would say we are a little bit a traditional think tank, and a little bit a development organization, and a little bit of everything. In that, again, you know, I think development in India there's so much fantastic work going on in India, but it's not always visible to very high levels of policy making, which is where the think tank sector sometimes is visible. And so we try to bridge that. So our clients are, and our partners, I don't like to say clients, we do partnership-based work. And they are anyone from, you know, currently we've got a big project running with a German foreign office. We have we've done projects with the Asia Foundation, which is a global foundation. We've done work with the Hinduja Foundation, which is a very big family-run philanthropic foundation in India that has a strong emphasis on water. And so we did a fantastic water mapping project with them to understand India from a water lens. You know, so just map the water situation in India outside of any possible like state or municipal boundary. So it's something that's ongoing right now. We've worked with Australia. We do work with the Indian Ministry of External Affairs. We've worked with city governments in India. So, you know, anyone and everyone that has the same kind of thinking that we have, where they see the value of a little bit like interconnected lenses, where if somebody were to say, okay, we want to work on urban and climate, and I will be like, okay, we have to bring in the women or the vulnerable communities angle to it. And they're like, no, that's not really what we want. We'll probably say no to them. You know, we don't want to work with people that don't have that kind of vision.
And so, for instance, the German Foreign Office, I mean, I don't expect you to tell us the whole story, but tell us a little bit, what's that first phone call like? Like, hi, I'm so-and-so, I work for the German Foreign Office, and we want you to do what?
If it was that easy, where someone picked up the phone and called me and said, let's do this, and I would have a much bigger outfit right now. But it actually that happened because I am a member of a global network that looks at the feminist foreign policy conversation. Feminist foreign policy collaborative is run by a wonderful woman named Lyric Thompson, who sits in the East Coast in America and runs the Feminist Foreign Policy Collaborative. And it's a global network of governments, representatives who have or have announced an intention for a feminist foreign policy. Also governments that are thinking about this, and then members of non-government civil society organizations like mine from around the world that work with these governments. So we've worked with the Dutch government, for example, on their gender strategy. We've worked with the Australian government on their gender strategy. Because my perspective on this is that if you are going to have a feminist foreign policy that makes sense to, you know, whatever, France or Germany or maybe one day America also, and you're going to
live in hope.
yes, we live and die eternally in hope, right? It is the worst thing in the world and the best thing in the world. But if you're going to bring that feminist foreign policy to India or to a country like India, you have to understand the Indian context to it. You cannot say, this is my feminism and that you should abide by my feminism. That doesn't make sense. So we give a lot of pushback, but I think it's important criticism and pushback to make those policies better. And so in that collaborative, there are some representatives from the German Foreign Ministry as well. And so in talking to them, we co-hatched out this idea of looking at how India and Germany have a number of different projects in the Indo-Pacific. There is a huge push to do more between these two countries in the Indo-Pacific. But how can then we have both these countries have a better gender or / feminist perspective to either existing projects or future projects? And so that's the work we are doing with the Foreign Office.
Got it. However, gender / feminist, those are not the same thing, right? So how do you, I mean, women are often like, that's the kind of the benchmark, you know, how many women are there in government? How many women are in their workforce? How many women feel safe walking around their neighborhoods? These are kind of benchmarks of a country's progress, if you will. And I think there's probably some value to that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that anybody's a feminist in any of this. So how do you quantify it, and how do you have those conversations about what actually needs to be done? Because just bringing more women into the conversation is not necessarily enough, or is it?
No, it's not enough. And that's not the only way to go about it. And I'll use the example of Mexico, for example. Mexico's ambassador currently in India, Mexico has a feminist foreign policy. Mexico will have elections in a few short weeks. In fact, this year there are what, 64 countries going into election.
I know, it's crazy here, right?
And I think Mexico is the only country where the two contenders for the top position are both women.
Mm.
They are both scientists, right? But this is a side fact that I like to squeeze into any conversation.
Yes,
because what a cool fact, right? But Mexico has a feminist foreign policy. But in India, Mexico's ambassador and the consul general in Mumbai, they're both men. They're both feminists. They both advocate for their feminist foreign policy, I think, in the best way that they can, because of the office, not because of the person. And that's how, that's where it should be. We should ultimately reach a place where we have the policy is designed in a way that anyone in that office can implement it in the best way possible for the end user or the end recipient of that policy. Yes, of course, you need to have more women in the conversation so that we can get to that point. But that's not the end. That should not be the end. More women should not be the end goal. The other important thing is that, and this is something I say a lot, and I get funny looks, but it needs to be said, is that the requirements of every country and the stage that they are at means that how they look at implementing any feminist policy or gender-based policy is different. And that recognition has to be there. You cannot say that, okay, my country requirements are more women in the political space, and so that's what your country requirements should be. This mm-hmm. is not the way to, this is not, you know, the way to go about it. Then you're going to receive pushback and no one's going to go anywhere. And so that is, I think, an important part of how feminist foreign policies can be implemented, which is also why we say at Kuba9, depending on the project we are working on, we could say feminist foreign policy, we say inclusive policy making as well, because in some cases that is the need. Inclusion from a gender perspective, inclusion from a vulnerable community perspective. And in some cases, we follow what the Indian government has chalked out as women-led development, because that is our journey at this point. Women-led development is where we need to be at, because on some levels, that is where India's, that is where we are at. And maybe the next step would be a feminist foreign policy, but I cannot immediately jump to that step without having gone through other steps. And so we try to sort of increase that understanding to countries that are coming from a different part of their journey.
Perhaps. Yeah, I love that. I love the kind of the recognition of meeting people where they're at. So you mentioned vulnerable communities. So is an awareness of how these policies impact vulnerable communities part of the feminism, or do you read that slightly differently?
I mean, I don't know if there is it's a black or white over there. I would say as a human, that's what I do.
Right.
Some people would say it's a feminist lens. But we work a lot with the climate community in India. And so if we had for example, we just completed a really excellent project with a Berlin-based think tank called Adelphi on looking at climate security in South Asia. And of course, there is the security people and the climate people, but we brought the development gender folk also, and we brought community folk, and we brought energy folk, we brought, you know, urban folk into that. And in some cases, people are like, why am I here in this discussion? And I'm like, be patient. I will explain to you why you're here. And then they leave that discussion after 2 days saying, okay, yeah, this makes sense, because some of this is part of what I do. Is that a feminist principle? Sure. But our goal is to say that it is an inclusive whole of approach principle, right? That
yeah.
thinking has to be there. And that's the approach I'm taking. Maybe it's a feminist for some people, maybe it's not feminist for some people. But I think it also depends on the history and the domestic context you're coming from. and you want to call me a feminist, I'm fine with that. You don't call me a feminist, I'm fine with that also.
You started off introducing yourself by saying, you know, you're not an engineer. You had your liberal arts education, which was unusual 25 years ago. I don't know if it's any less unusual now, maybe a little bit less unusual, but I feel that there's still so much emphasis on STEM, both in South Asia and for people of students of South Asian origin or heritage. Do you think that your desire, it's more than a desire, it's really a self-imposed mandate to think broadly, to think holistically, stems, no pun intended, from that liberal arts background? Like, you see yourself as a kind of a holistic person?
Probably not. I didn't set out to be this way. When I went to a liberal arts education, I actually wanted to be a journalist. And then I studied political science. And so I equally thank and blame my professors back in the day for the shift. I do think that the people that I had who were teaching me both in my undergraduate and then and my both my master's after that did have certain influence in that ability to think wide and deep. And the more I work on a number of different projects, as you know, or we have teams that work on different projects, and as someone who oversees all of that, I see the value of that interconnectedness that I perhaps didn't see before. A liberal arts education is important. But I think a broad education is important. You know, there is no, of course, saying that there is one needs the engineers and one needs the doctors and the scientists and the lawyers. And if you're a doctor or a lawyer, of course, that single point thinking is really required. But if you're something else, even if you're an engineer or you're a climate scientist or a water engineer or an urban designer, you have to be able to place what you are doing in a larger context. Because today, if you cannot do that, then you're not doing your job well. Especially if you're like for an urban designer, for example, you have to think about the climate aspects of urban design. You have to think about migration aspects. You cannot just say, I'm a designer and, you know, I'm going to design these beautiful homes and design beautiful real estate and not think about like heat, right? So now maybe you don't have to be a heat expert, but you have to understand what the relationship to your design is with heat and make sure you have that person who is the heat expert as part of your thinking when you do that design.
Yeah,
there is a definite value there.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned that you are, or I introduced you as having been at Stanford recently. Tell us more about that visit. What was that about? And was it, well, there's only one right answer to this question. Was it productive?
Yeah, it was very productive.
It's yes!
The first time I have been to Stanford. And so it was wonderful. I walked around the whole campus. I was there to meet with Arjan Tarapur, who's a research scholar. And works on the Indo-Pacific India, US, India, Australia relations. Because I was there and it was my first time, of course, I had to walk around and it's such a beautiful campus. I also had a friend who drove me around Palo Alto and I saw all the, you know, one Meta Way and one this way and one all those fancy buildings. And I was like, okay, this is where everything happens, right? But my main purpose, of course, like I said, was to have a meeting with Arzan. We talked a lot about the opportunities for more collaboration, you know, between research institutes in India, specifically Kuvanine and Stanford. I gave him, you know, from a domestic lens, as someone who lives in India, just thoughts on what's happening in India right now, domestic politics, how that plays into foreign policy. Of course, we talked a little bit about the elections, that is unavoidable. But given Arzan's background as an Australian as well, we talked quite a bit about India and Australia and how that is playing out in the Indo-Pacific. You know, there's a lot of collaboration happening between India and Australia and the Indo-Pacific, more specifically looking at the Pacific Islands and Oceania and that region. And he's got a fantastic class right now going on the Indo-Pacific. So just some thoughts and discussions about that. And hopefully this will all materialize into something more formal in the future. So we're excited about that.
Well, and I'm so glad that you're able to bring your kind of holistic lens, if I may call it that, to these discussions, because I'm sure Arzan would be extremely aware of the need for that. But I don't know that Stanford as a entity always is as inclusive as it might like to think of itself. So, yay, I'm really glad these conversations are happening. What's next for you, Ambika? What are some of your projects that you've got lined up, or some of your visions that you're going to map out in the next, I don't know, year, 2 years, 10 years? I don't know. Think big, think small. I don't know.
So we've got this project that's running with the German Foreign Office, and the first phase of that will conclude in 2024, and the next phase of that we hope to go deeper into that. So some of our findings, briefs are already on our website on kuba9initiative.com, but we want to see more what India and Germany can do. The lens we are using is looking at climate, trade, digitalization, and what that means for bilateral partnerships, but also what does that mean for trilateral and minilateral partnerships, right? Because India is very fond of these minilateral partnerships.
What's a minilateral partnership? Forgive my ignorance.
Minilaterals are now, I guess, small multilaterals. To do these like 3, 4, 5 country partnerships. And I think it's easier for us to have a more control also. And I think that's important. Sometimes big multilateral systems get a bit unwieldy, and
for sure,
the smaller ones are more nimble. And I think in some ways that is very useful. So what does that mean? So that's the kind of we're looking at. The Indian government is quite interested also in what can they do more, what can they do better, because we have we've got a fairly decently strong history of positive development assistance projects globally, you know, especially in Africa. We've done a lot of work on peacekeeping, education. So how can we bring some of that learning? And our analysis has been that let's look at the gender side of what we have done. There's been quite a good body of work. Let's learn from that. Let's design around it, not just have it by default, and then take it to our other regions that we plan to be working on. So that's something we are keen on doing more on in the next couple of years. And then the security side of it, climate security is a big conversation globally, but definitely in South Asia. But in some ways, climate security is very siloed in that they look at the security side of it, energy, renewable energy, emissions, heat. This is all the conversation. But where does water play into all of this? I'd like to increase that research and so on, analysis in that space. How can we bring the community voices into the policymaking debate? And so we'd like to do more on that. So these are some of the big things that I'm thinking about. And then domestically on water, we want to do more on water. Water is, for too long in India, has been seen as a resource that's abundant. We have a lot of water in many places, but not enough in others. Yeah. A lot of it is because just poor management in the past, access is low. But in increasing that access, can we do it, one, in an equitable manner, and in a manner that the resource is safeguarded also for the future? Not just, you know, build all these pipes and give water to everyone, which is important, but do it in a fashion that 10, 15 years later, we are not dealing with some other problem. So that's the work that we are also looking at doing more going in the future.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast and for doing great work at Stanford and for all the great work you do. You already said the website, if you can just say it one more time for people who are interested in following up. And if you have any social media, this is also the place to mention that.
Yes. Okay. So our website is www.kubernineinitiative.com. That's KUBERNEIN initiative.com. We are at Kubernine on X. And I am at the Idle Thinker also on X. I have to say Twitter. We are also on Kubernine is also on LinkedIn, which is at Kubernine Initiative on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Well, everybody can follow Ambika and Kubernine and find out more about all the great projects ahead. Thank you so much for making time for me today.
Thank you so much, Lalita. This was a great conversation.
As always, thanks to Soham Shiva for creating the beautiful music at the start and the end of the podcast, and Manar Faithful-Kinnear for post-production. Thank you for listening to the SASPOD, the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast. Find out all about the Stanford Center for South Asia at southasia.stanford.edu and find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you can tune in again soon. Joke.